Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. This is episode 2 of the series Pandemic Psychodynamics. And today we're talking to Bridget Nozzle from Melbourne, Australia. Bridget is the co-founder and co-director of the National Institute of Organizational Dynamics, and they deliver a fabulous master's in leadership and management, taking a psychodynamic systems approach. Bridget combines academic teaching and research with organizational consulting. She has recently served on the board of ISPSO and is a registered analytic network coach. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you.
Bridget, I was reading something you'd written, and you wrote that 21st century leadership demands the capacity to be able to tolerate uncertainty and to be emotionally present in the moment rather than focus on an ideal future. Can we start with leadership and kind of what you think is going on in Australia around leadership in general, politics, work? So just what you mean by being able to tolerate uncertainty and be emotionally present?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very general sort of remark. I guess it's something that I think really informs the course that I teach. It's also something I believe very strongly, and it seems to mark a stark contrast with a lot of what I meet in organisations and certainly what's going on in politics here in Australia, which tends to be something much more driven by whether it's a collective expectation. It seems to be a collective expectation, and I mean, I'll kind of say this very broadly across both the nation and organisations, that leaders are somebody's who know. You know, they know how to respond to this. They know what the right answer is. And the consequence of that, I mean, that we're seeing play out here in relation to COVID-19 is this kind of following, you know, very quickly on the tail of whatever seems to be the best solution coming from another country that may be a few days ahead of us or a few weeks ahead of us. So it has this tinge, certainly a sense of being very reactive, difficult to stop and think about the real consequences of what's being led. I mean, I was going to say what's being co-created, but I mean, I think it's being led ahead of it being co-created. And, you know, my reflection kind of leading up to this session is that I think in the Australian context, I mean, Australians are a people who, I mean, there's a limit to what you can say about a nationality, but we have these kind of cultural fantasies, if you like, about ourselves as being, you know, that we began as a penal colony and therefore we are anti-authoritarian and we like our independence, we like to rebel. And yet I guess what we've seen in reaction to COVID-19 is a completely unexpected level of compliance. I'll share personally for me that when the news about this pandemic broke, one of the first things that came to mind was an article that I read back in probably about November last year. And it was a commentary about the way our universities here are so heavily geared to the international market and reliant upon international students to a tune of something like 25% of their budget. Mm-hmm. And the commentary was saying, you know, it's a big risk when you're talking about doing business with a country like China, which has the power to just close its borders whenever it likes. And so it was only 2 months after that that's exactly what happened. And I can remember my sort of sense of shock, horror, because it had a huge immediate impact on our universities in particular. as, you know, hundreds of thousands of students were about to make their way here and the borders were closed. And, you know, the Hubei province was shut down. And I had this kind of, I know my own internal reaction was kind of like only in China. And so I think there's been this really, for me, this kind of sense of surprise. I mean, it's a surprise about my own internal compliance as much as our collective compliance.
I mean, that raises an interesting question. That it's in my discussions with people around the pandemic and the psychodynamics, it seems to me that the COVID-19 is revealing things about ourselves which we either partially knew or had repressed. And this juxtaposition between Australia being the maverick kind of country, doesn't obey rules, and now very conformist. Have you any sense around kind of what that means for Australians? Does it, in the future, does it kind of say anything about the future for Australia?
It feels too early to tell. Mm-hmm. I mean, and interestingly, I'm involved at the moment in co-hosting what we're calling an open reflection space in NIOTA for the kind of NIOTA community, our students, our board members, our staff. I'm doing that with Susan Long. And so, I mean, it's interesting how themes and experiences seep through, because it's quite an eclectic group of people that are coming together to share reflections across an hour and 15 minutes. One of the things that your question's reminding me of was that came up in this session with Susan, who raised it, which is, well, we call it compliance. Might we also think about it as collaboration?
Uh-huh.
So sort of, you know, opening it up to say, you know, is this a reaction to a really authoritarian shutdown, or is this a kind of something more sensitive, sensitized, intelligent, saying, you know, there's a real risk here. There is a risk to life. And perhaps it makes sense that we cooperate, collaborate, that we join in this endeavor. And right now there's a kind of mass, you know, collective patting ourselves on the back about the fact that the objective was to flatten the curve, that it's virtually done away with it altogether.
That's interesting. So it's possibly a more mature response from Australians than one may have expected, rather than an adolescent rebellion. It's kind of a mature, it could be interpreted as a mature kind of a collaborative response.
It could be. You know, I must say a part of me thinks that's a rather generous interpretation. But, you know, to just make it available for thinking about, what is that?
Yeah.
And I know that we're seeing it kind of replicated in so many parts of the world. I think, you know, any of my international colleagues who I come into contact with are all self-isolating. You know, they're all working online. You know, as we began here, this sort of combination working at home, partners working at home with children trying to homeschool, and, you know, there's a kind of collectivity in that goes broader than our national borders. I just thought it was interesting to think about, because I must say my own kind of fantasies, and I think they're shared in the spaces where thinking is open up to it, kind of tend more towards something like 1984. And we have a debate going on right now about the Prime Minister wanting to introduce this tracing map. App.
Yeah.
And for it to be of any use, there needs to be kind of 40% compliance. And, you know, perhaps this is where the more rebellious anti-authoritarian spirit is coming out, because the predictions really are that people will say, no
enough.
Way.
Yeah, enough. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm working on a new blog, thinking about kind of the shift from the 1950s, we shifted from a society of society of prohibition, where the kind of people paid attention to authority figures and institutions and And then we shifted into kind of the post-60s countercultural movement and into the kind of society of command and enjoyment. And this is a sudden shift back to the society of prohibition. And my imaginary was a bit like yours. I kind of expected prohibition to kind of get quite a lot of pushback, that actually people kind of always want to move into transgression when it comes to prohibition. But there's another kind of thought which arose to me, was that there's quite a lot of authors, even in our field, talking about kind of we need a return of the father. You know, the father got kind of annihilated and castrated after the 1950s, and this new terrible society is kind of not making any good. And suddenly we're back to kind of an authoritarian kind of government. You know, in some places, like in Hungary, it's getting kind of extreme, where Orban's taking back complete control. But people have actually kind of, collaborated, gone along with so far. Although there are signs in different countries, in Spain, there's people like just going absolutely crazy, banging pots and things, saying like, let our children out. Because they, you know, when it goes too far, when prohibition goes too far, they locked up the children for 6 weeks, not even allowing them out of their apartments. So,
yeah.
There's a pushback. So it's going to be very interesting to see how we manage that kind of shift, and how governments kind of manage to shift from prohibition back into kind of a sense of kind of a collaboration, and rather than being coercive in their approaches, being more kind of collaborative with their citizens. So I'm very interested to see how kind of that pans out in different parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, some of what I'd imagined was, you know, at what point will the rebellion begin? You know, that it begins with a sort of cooperation and compliance. I think as we go from day to day, seeing the figures continue to lessen, you know, without the kind of dramatic increase in new infections and deaths that we've seen internationally, you know, and it's interesting to try and think about why has it progressed in such a different way here in Australia. And there are some obvious things about the fact that we are an island, quite a long way from a lot of places, you know, where the action is going on. And I mean, I think this also kind of seeps into what I was reflecting on in terms of, you know, what are the more subtle or unconscious things in play here that are uniquely part of the Australian psyche. Yeah. You know, the whole border control issue has been so fraught that in a way it's like as if that push within one sector of society to shut down the borders is getting great gratification right now. You know, even in the reflections, within our reflection session, this sort of hopefulness about if perhaps we can do things differently, perhaps this is a kind of test, perhaps this is an invitation to, you know, when we restart the economy, that we will pay attention to the environment. But somehow subtly in there, I kind of wonder about a subtle nationalism, you know, that tends, and sorry, I mean, I think this meets your point about the new authoritarianism. Because perhaps there is this kind of collective wish to return to something, more nationalistic with closed borders. Because I think we know our curve presumably only stays as flat as it is while the borders are closed.
No, it really does feed into kind of potential new authoritarianism, and from a populist nationalist kind of perspective, it's like, you know, we told you closing borders was a good idea. We told you not letting immigrants in was a good idea. You can see how it kind of fits with that kind of narrative. I mean, in that paper, I just had a thought. In that paper I wrote about the new authoritarians, I also made the case that the liberal progressive movement was also authoritarian in a much softer way. They weren't outwardly going for kind of borders and nationalism. But there was a lot of coercion and control of speech and in the political correct movement, which kind of got out of hand in the USA in particular.
Yeah, I mean, we see it play out here as well. And And absolutely. And I mean, there are forms of that, the kind of COVID-19 variety playing out. You go out into the street and people kind of cross to the other side and frown upon you. It's like we've got a new kind of political correctness about how to do social distancing and are you staying far away enough from each other? And, you know, at the same time, are you making sure that you support your local producers? And there are all these contradictions in terms of, you know, what we ought to be doing.
Yeah, you know, and I personally, I'm a naturally a rebellious person. I kind of came from an anarchist background, and it kind of still plays out in me. I can feel my kind of, they tell me in Ireland I have to stay within 2 kilometres of my home, you know, so I transgress, of course, you know. I can't wait to go just over 2 kilometres, you know, and sort of get beyond the border. But I actually get quite angry when, you know, they're kind of shutting down beaches and open spaces. And I'm like, you know, open spaces don't spread the virus. You know, we're not talking about big gatherings. They shut down kind of big parts of the beaches, which means that people congregate on the smaller parts in greater numbers. It's kind of irrational.
It's insane. Yeah.
And that kind of irrational kind of top-down kind of approach really doesn't make sense. I mean, for me, leadership really has to kind of going back to the initial point, has to kind of really think on its feet, like be in that kind of moment, as you kind of rightly say, and kind of think about how to kind of create social cohesion. I think it's really important here. You know, like the minute it tips into kind of over coerciveness, then we've got real problems, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and we've got that occurring sort of to an insane degree. It's just, you know, kind of ramped up, and I expect it will kind of ramp back. But, you know, police kind of publishing how many people they've done spot checks on to find out where they're going, and you know, how many fines have been issued, you know, many of them mistakenly, because there's also a lot of confusion around what the actual constraints are. You know, on the one hand, cafes can stay open, but the only reason you're allowed to go out shopping is for the chemist or the grocery store. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm allowed to pick up a coffee on my way. But sorry, I did drift quite a bit from that original point about leadership and what's meant by that. But
yeah, no, I think it's coming through the conversation. It's important. What about diversity in Australia? Are there marginalised groups getting hit worse? Like in America, African Americans are kind of taking a big hit. Have you any kind of insights into what's going on in Australia?
I think where we're seeing it, Simon, because our numbers really are relatively low, and the majority of people who've actually got the virus, or you know, the transmissions have come predominantly from people returning from overseas. So in terms of that, I guess in a way the actual infections to this point have probably been amongst the middle classes. So we're not seeing it so much in terms of the actual infection rate as is happening in other countries. Where we're seeing it is who is being hit by the restrictions, and that is devastating. And the differences in how that's occurring is you know, we've got large tracts. I think you'll probably remember from January that well-published map that showed such a big section of our country burning. So we have huge numbers of communities still reeling from the loss of income due to the bushfires and people not being able to go, to now reeling from the impact of coronavirus. So, you know, they've kind of had one come so quickly on the heels of another, where you've got a lot of communities that rely upon the transient fruit-picking kinds of populations, but also the youth tourism and any kind of tourism, actually.
No, I was thinking a lot about that when I wrote the blog COVID-19 and Intrusion of the Real, taking a Lacanian kind of perspective. I mentioned the Australian fires in there because it seems to me that COVID-19 is not some sort of isolated thing which just comes out of nature suddenly inflicts it on us. It's part of a much wider kind of ecosystem of humans, technology, and globalization, like this mass travel, this kind of loss of kind of biodiversity, kind of climate change, climate warming, you know, and these kind of sparking off local events like in Australia, the fires were a local event which kind of stayed local, you know. This virus, it was a local event kind of which actually went global, and these things are kind of just so interrelated, you know. The Australian fires were a local event but caused by a global phenomena, you know, so it's...
Yeah, absolutely.
These kind of interrelationships between kind of nature, technology and humans and what we do. For me, it's like, you know, really throwing up kind of like, you know, this is kind of, this is the questions we have to address in the here and now. We can't kind of wait for climate change to address it kind of in a decade's time. This is kind of a real wake-up call for us to kind of say kind of how we're going to kind of create the good society in the next kind of decade.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I don't feel like it's really entered the kind of national narrative at this point. It's definitely there in, you know, in our reflective space, this kind of linking the impact of the bushfires, the huge raising of awareness, the pressure from the global community for Australia to kind of stand up and do something in that space. And we have so much opportunity, particularly with energy generation, solar, hydrogen. You know, we have opportunities. I think there is a great opportunity right now with things shut down. And I think this is sort of where the counter to the despair and depression that is there, and this kind of franticness that's also seems to have entered people.
Yeah.
Generally. I mean, you get it every time you go online and meet a group of people incredibly frantic. So, I mean, there's this interesting kind of mixture of despair and fear and franticness, and also a sort of hopefulness about what opportunities it raises, and can that narrative that was begun and that pressure that was begun with the bushfires continue and actually find its opportunity for a kind of transformation. But I have to say, it doesn't seem to be anywhere in the political discourse right now. You know, focus is on employment figures, well, as it appropriately should be, but it's sort of really more on the curve. It's, you know, all flattening the curve. We're all in this together.
And we need to get back to growth as quick as we can.
We need to get back to growth, absolutely. I feel like the opportunity is there, and I don't feel very hopeful about it being taken up.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's kind of a real battle going to be had around kind of how we come out of this, because there's a huge opportunities for us to shift the way we do things, the way our actual way of being in the world. You know, it's a fundamental kind of way of being in the world. We've had the 20th century way of being in the world, which has used nature's resources as if they're kind of going to last forever, and we've seen the consequences of that, and this disparity between the rich and the poor just growing and growing. We've kind of been on that track, and there's an opportunity to change, but kind of there's going to be a huge kind of political global battle around kind of what that looks like. And of course, the immediate reaction is kind of a short-termism, back to growth, and let's get some jobs. You know, sort of Trumpism gone wild. We can kind of see that is on the agenda. I was thinking, Bridget, of the psychic kind of awareness which arises. You said something about kind of, you know, we're a distant country. Do you think that I'm interested in kind of the psychic awareness, like in the UK and Britain, they've gone through this Brexit thing, and I've been observing that closely, being a Brit myself. And they made some pretty phenomenal mistakes, it looks like, you know, that not joining in the European kind of group which kind of obtained all the PPEs and the protective gear. They kind of had this idea of being separate, and it's kind of come to sting them badly. But Australia is this distant land from Europe, but full of kind of ex-Europeans and our nations now. But what kind of psychic sense do you think it kind of awareness makes Australians think about themselves. What kind of insights do you think it kind of reflects back on Australian citizens as kind of who they are in the world in a global sense?
I think, one thing that I think has probably entered our consciousness is this interdependence with other countries. So, you know, on the one hand, we are notionally this island population, but as in the example I gave earlier about how leveraged our university system as one example, but in actual fact, yeah. it's I think part of what's beginning to emerge is a real questioning, possibly not in a good way, a suspiciousness about, you know, the amount of our economy that is dependent upon trade with China in particular. Yeah. Of course, and we have a much closer neighbour, Indonesia. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, we're only about 6 weeks into this, and mm-hmm. we're probably only about 3 weeks into the real restrictive restrictions. So it's a little bit hard to predict, but I kind of think in terms of what's likely to seep into the psyche in terms of what we already know, I can imagine perhaps hardening of the closure on the borders, and that extending then to this reliance upon external economies, perhaps a return to, in fact, I have seen some commentaries about that, a kind of return to what we can do here for ourselves. Locally made, locally grown, locally manufactured. So I think there's a real heightened awareness of how dependent we've become. I mean, interestingly, I think we might have been the first country to start the toilet paper hysteria. And, you know, I think it was initiated by the fantasy that toilet paper was manufactured somewhere overseas and it was all going to shut down. In actual fact, it's not. It's one of the few products that we do manufacture here. So, I mean, there's something of a mystery surrounding that phenomenon. But certainly I think it's a sort of heightened awareness of our absolute dependence on countries like China, mingled with this was where the virus came from, and the slightly undercurrent paranoid, was it really a virus that came from a bat in a market, or, you know, was this the beginning of some kind of alternative warfare? So I'm sure that's happening in other parts of the world as well. But I think Australia, thinking of itself as so well resourced in many ways, I can imagine a kind of turning inwards.
And again that can go two ways, can't it? I mean, there's a localism which can be very healthy, that, you know, growing local food so you're not kind of bringing food millions of miles away and stuff, with 3D printing, we're going to be able to kind of make more stuff locally. That can be a very healthy kind of dynamic, or it could be a very sort of paranoid, kind of closed down, kind of anti-other dynamic, which is a kind of the danger which goes along with it. So it's kind of walking that tightrope and getting that right. Before we started on the conversation live, Bridget, we talked about kind of the busyness of work. Can you just reflect a bit on kind of what it feels like around doing things online and what it is to kind of work in this new environment?
Yes, and I mean, I think I have a very particular experience of that, because the nature of my work is one where I meet other people at work through my students. I mean, they're all full-time working professionals and the majority of them have kept their job. And so, you know, you come onto this Zoom screen, you know, like with the Brady Bunch, the people there, and there is a something that gets amplified, you know, because it's, I don't really know how to describe it, except that I come away with a level of exhaustion that's new. And I hear it repeated in just about everyone I speak to. Mm-hmm. You know, the students share their level of exhaustion from their day's work, working online. And I think, You know, part of it is, well, part of it is just the literalness of what it means to be living, for example, in an apartment with your three children home, having to set them up for homeschooling, while also doing your own full-time job and having your partner in the house in the background as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we're pretty lucky in Australia that apartment living is not the majority. You know, yeah. So a lot of people are kind of living this out with the reality of having a backyard or a front yard or a street or you know, a house as distinct from an apartment. But, I mean, it's an interesting contrast where you have on the one hand this really crowded experience of families all living at home together and then on the other hand extreme isolation of people who live on their own. You know, and so come to the experience with that kind of emotional undertow. A student was sharing the other day about the experience of trying to begin a dating life when you can't actually go out and meet people. You know, so you're stuck at home on your own in an apartment trying to meet people for the first time online and find new ways of interacting. I've had the interesting experience of trying to run a very, very small study group online because when the virus first hit, two students were not able to continue, which took our class from six down to four. And, you know, we've persisted with it, but it's kind of raised all sorts of interesting questions about the flat surface versus the three-dimensional one that we're used to working in. And what it seems to amplify and heighten as well as what it seems to denude.
I think it's one of the things, I mean, this COVID has revealed again is that, you know, one, that when this started, a lot of people seem to be, this is fantastic. We don't have to go to work anymore. We can work from home. It's kind of going great. We could just Zoom and people kind of realize that there's a huge potential here. And then pretty quickly it slipped into something not quite working as it used to here, and it's like more difficult and it's more exhausting and it's kind of harder to really connect. And I've worked online for many years now. I was with you actually, you know, president of ISBSO. We ran ISBSO as an online international meetings with Zoom for many years, and face-to-face meetings twice a year, but we didn't half enjoy the face-to-face meetings or found them very important. Without those, it would have been much more difficult. But I think it's another question that's going to leave with us after this is kind of how much work can be done online and how much work is needed face-to-face and the importance of that 3D, that kind of connectedness in person. Those questions are kind of out there, I think, and that's very, very interesting.
Well, I mean, the ISPSO is a good example because I think there was, you know, when things got difficult, or interesting in terms of the dynamics, and this is what I'm finding in teaching as well, that there's something about the loss of the embodied experience to be able to really work with the difficult dynamics when they surface.
Yeah.
And I guess the consequence of that is they just don't get properly worked and they fester for longer. As a result.
I think that's something we should maybe co-author a paper on, Bridget, because that's really interesting that it's almost like you can do some task focused stuff and it works pretty well, but when it comes to the process work, that's much more problematic. And
I've got a bit of data to that which I'm finding interesting, and you know, haven't managed to completely resolve, but because it obviously it's an ongoing experience, but where the whole idea is that they get to learn about dynamics and what we're capable of doing to each other in subtle ways. And yes, you know, trying to be the container for that experience when you can't be a body breathing in a room it's interesting.
Containment on Zoom, next paper. Excellent. Good. Yeah. Listen, Bridget, we're coming to the end of the podcast. It's been a delight talking to you. Any final thoughts on how to live a good life or how we, I think we've discussed quite a bit about kind of what the good society might look like and the potential for that or the opposite. So I think that that's been covered quite a lot. But anything about kind of living a good life in times of trauma, any thoughts on how to keep psychically healthy?
I think it's been a really good experience, this reflective space that we've opened up. And I think the people who turn up to it, and it's my experience as well, to make the space available for talking together and thinking together about what this experience is. What's been curious about it is the numbers. You know, when we started it probably about 4 weeks ago, we had about 30 people there, and it was like this, you know, pulling the plug out of a sink, this sort of huge sigh of relief that there's somewhere that we can come. And I'm not sure whether the reason that the numbers are dropping off is that people are finding a different kind of accommodation with this way of working. Some people that weren't able to make it could say, it's enough just to know that it's there and that it's going on. So I think there's something really powerful about putting the time aside, notwithstanding the franticness, to join with others to really consider what is this experience in here and now, to have this kind of conversation. You know, I'll link that back to what I said about leadership, you know, being available to think about the real experience that we're having, that others are having. And, you know, what can we learn from it in terms of going broader with the good life? You know, thinking again about the environment, that we've actually had some experience of what restrictiveness is like. How might that continue in a positive way? You know, I think so often en masse, it's like we're so unwilling to give things up for the sake of the environment, that perhaps having had a taste of it, there might be more of a willingness.
Yeah, I think you've beautifully summarized psychodynamic systems there, where you talk about going into reflective space and really thinking about what's going on in our experience in real time, and then making those links, not just leaving it there, but making those links to kind of what we can do in the wider system. So that's really helpful.
And that's been happening, so that feels hopeful. Mm.
Good work, Bridget. Listen, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you very much for your time and contributions.
Thanks,
and insight. And thank you all for listening. And I look forward to being with you on the next episode. Goodbye for now.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.